Digging Deeper Without the Cold Face, the podcast that shares the incredible stories of the talented and passionate people in our industry. And it's now time for this week's episode of Digging Deeper Without the Cold Face. Proudly sponsored by CAPS Australia, a leading provider of compressed air and power generation solutions that are made for Australian conditions and backed by dedicated local service. Keep your operations running smoothly with CAPS Australia. It's your host, Jessica Rouse.
Now, if you've ever picked up a copy of Queensland's At the Coalface, and especially if you live in central Queensland, you know all about Cap Rescue. Already this year, the team has spent 430 hours in the air attending accidents, winching patients from cruise ships, transferring babies, adults, and conducting lots of missions in very remote areas of central Queensland. Now, Cap Rescue wouldn't exist without some incredible support from big business to the community, and today we've got some very special guests on this episode. Tracy Snedden, the Community Relations Coordinator at Glencore, Kim, Cap Rescue's Communications and Engagement Officer, and Cap Rescue Aircrew Officer Alan Griffiths. So guys, thank you for joining me on this episode.
Our pleasure.
Kim, I want to start with you. For anyone listening in Queensland or elsewhere, who is Cap Rescue?
So how long have you got? So Cap Rescue, look, we're an amazing organisation that exists in central Queensland. We go out as far as Alpha, up to St Lawrence, down to Agnes, and then off the coast as far as we can. And basically within that area, our job is to save lives. So we're going to those facilities that don't have the advanced medical care that people need and bringing them back to Rockhampton or to Brisbane or to Gladstone. We're also going out to those road accidents where maybe time is critical and the ambulance on the road can't quite get there fast enough. Or we're going out to those properties where a vehicle can't get to. So, you know, we're landing on those places. And it's just, we're the lifeline, really, within the air in central Queensland. And you know, that 350,000 square kilometres that we cover is, you know, really just, you know, we're the lifeline for everybody within that area.
It's a silly question, really, to ask how important and crucial the service is to central Queenslanders.
It is. Look, I think anybody you speak with in this area knows somebody or has some sort of background when it comes to Cap Rescue, previously known as Capricorn Helicopter Rescue Service. We had to shorten it. It was too hard to say on the phone. But, yeah, even this year alone, like you touched on, you know, it's 260 lives that we've saved this year alone, and we're only sort of, you know, halfway through the year. And all of those people had loved ones. They all have workmates. They all have friends. And they all have people who they mean someone to. So we can rattle statistics off until, you know, the cows come home. But at the end of the day, each one of those people has a face and a story behind it.
Yeah, exactly. And I always feel so lucky when we manage to get one of the aircrew officers or the paramedics on for a chat or an interview or anything like that. And today we're very lucky to have Alan with us. Alan, you're an aircrew officer with Cap Rescue. Tell us, what does that entail for you?
All right, so my primary role would be to be the pilot's left-hand man. So I sit up the front with the pilot, but I'm not hands on the controls, so to speak. So I help him with the navigation, the communications, and then also just the scene assessment. If we need to land in a tight area, I'll climb into the back and then be the eyes, because from the front, you can't see everything. You can't see where the tail is. So we get in the back and then we have a much better field of view. And appreciation of the area and where we could fit the aircraft into. So we often can just land into a pretty tight space. And then if we can't fit at all, we'll just set up for doing a winch. And so that's when we operate the winch in the back and we check the crew in the back with us, a rescue crew officer, the paramedic and the doctor. And depending on what the situation requires, we can winch all one or all three plus equipment down to them. And then they can set up the patient inside our equipment, like the stretcher. And then we can winch them back into the aircraft. So it's a small team. It's a team of four, five if it's a primary, like a roadside or a winching operation. And, yeah, we work in a small team. We all sort of have overlap. We all help each other out, and it's a pretty cool team environment to be in when it's that small.
Yeah. Now, how did you land the job with Cap Rescue? Give us a bit of your background. How on earth do you get into a role like this?
All right. So I grew up in Newcastle. New South Wales. I have lots of friends who were associated with the mines, lots of mates, dads worked in the mines, and, you know, they talk about the service down there is obviously Westpac, And so they talk about them, and that, you know, that was like hand on heart. So we donate to Westpac because on our worst day, they're there for us. And it's that sort of, that sort of mentality is the same as what's up here as well. And so I grew up with that. I saw them flying around. I was like, that's so cool. And then I finished school and I did my, I built boats and drove boats, which I know seems like a bit of a tangent, but it does link up incredibly. And then I saw The Guardian, as like everybody does, and The Perfect Storm, and I was like, I want to do that. I want to be the rescue swimmer. And so, yeah, I was a rescue crew officer for 10 years and doing all of the in-water stuff, not as wild as what it looks like on The Guardian because that's Hollywood. but, yeah, so I was doing that, and then natural progression, and just I worked up to being an aircraft officer. So instead of being on the wobbly end of the hook, now I'm on the controlling end of the hook. So, yeah, it's a progression within the industry. It's not a quick progression, but, it's a long game.
Yeah. So how long have you been with Cat Rescue now?
So I've been in Cat Rescue since the beginning of this year.
Yep.
Yep. So we moved up from Brisbane, my family and I, and, yeah, we have already added more to the population since being up here. We've had our third boy. but, yeah, so we moved from the hustle and bustle of Brisbane up to Rockhampton with a fair bit of excitement because we're small town regional people. Like you're part of a community. It's all good.
Yeah, exactly. Yep. And Kim and I mentioned that this first 6 months of the year have been very busy for the service. Is there a mission or a memorable or heartwarming moment that you've experienced this year with Cat Rescue?
Yep, I'll definitely say that something memorable is I'm not going to get a horse. Like, it seems like horses seem to be a part of a lot of not so good missions.
Yeah.
Yep, so we've been to lots of horses. But no, we've been a part of like winches or just associated with rescues where it's in such a remote location, and it's just been, if we weren't there, there actually would have been no other way of getting out. Yeah. And it's just, it kind of feels warm and fuzzy when you can go in there. It's like, wow, we really did. Not saying we're amazing, just the service is amazing. Like the fact that no, because the service was there, because we could be there on that day, because all of that lined up.
Yeah.
And like that was able to be a positive outcome for the family. But then what you don't remember is that there's the ripple effect of that positive outcome for the actual patient. It's the families and the friends that are connected to that. And that can go both ways. If it's a negative outcome, that hurts all of these people. But when it's a positive one, that just reinforces the need for a service like this. And it just strengthens it, just bolsters it for everybody in the community.
Yeah, exactly. And on that too, you mentioned like you're the second man next to the pilot and you're basically another set of eyes for him. Has there been a challenging mission that comes to mind that really tested your skills?
Yeah, definitely. But would you believe that like the testing is not always the skills bit, because we do train a lot so that you don't think about the skills aspect.
Yeah.
What you don't train for is the emotion or the bigger decisions that you've got to make along the way. We were involved in a case down at 1770 recently, which unfortunately didn't have a positive outcome, but it was sort of able to make a positive angle on a negative outcome. And it's sometimes you've just got to make those big decisions as to what's the best thing we can do here for the patient and the family. Don't want to be too obvious about which particular case in 1770, but yeah, like sometimes it's the bigger decisions that is harder than what the skills are. So we can practice for skills, but you can't practice for those big decisions that can affect like the patient and the families like that. So that would be my biggest one.
Yeah. Yeah. And I feel like with the work that you do as well, you know, you would have to be keeping yourself in check and looking after yourself. You would see so many things and be a part of so many of other people's emotions. And I guess, you know, as much as you wouldn't want to be taking that on every mission, it would be hard. You wouldn't be able to ignore it, right?
So that's a really good question. I learned very early in my career that you can't connect too much because I know I was quite junior. And I did connect, and I got caught up, and it was good that I could connect to help the situation, but it broke me afterwards. And I was like, right, I'll take this learning experience. And you're not It's not eating part of your soul. Like, you're not shutting off to the world. You're just learning from it and just going, okay, I need to focus on my job. And what they need from me right now is to have absolute focus on the big picture. And so there was a lesson learned earlier in my career, and I can still recall it now. Not that I will. But yeah, you, whilst you do connect and you empathize completely, because I have three boys, they're all under five, like, you can connect, but your primary role is to do your job and to do it very well.
Yeah. So take us through, Alan, if a situation is unfolding and I guess 000 has been called, when does Cat Rescue come in? What happens? Walk us through it.
All right. So start the clock. When someone calls 000, then you'll be diverted to whichever necessary asset that is. From there, someone will be listening in, and then they'll basically say, oh, this could be a job for a helicopter. And then they'll transfer us to what's called Retrieval Services Queensland, which is RSQ. We like three-letter acronyms. And then RSQ basically control all of the assets for Queensland, Retrieval Services Queensland. And they are very busy. It's not just us. They're controlling all of the assets. So they'll then ascertain who the best asset for that area is, who can get there the quickest, who's got the greatest capability for that particular task. So they'll make an assessment as to who they think might be closest, best fit. Then they will call that person in. If it's for us, they'll call us and just say, hi, guys, we've got this task at this location. Would you be able to look into this for us? Obviously, it's one of those hasten slowly things. Like, you want to move as quickly as possible, but at the same time, it's about precision and it's about getting it right the first time and just not waffling about, being very precise with your actions. So from there, they're trying to get the best information that they can. So they want to know where. If you can give them 2 points of location, so if you can get a latitude and a longitude, which is pretty easy to come by on anyone's iPhone these days, and then also a street address, they're also pinging the phone anyway. But the more information you can give them, like good information, the better, because then that limits the amount of time that we have to sort of look. Because there's times that we'll be given a position and then we get out there and it's not quite the position. And so then we're wasting valuable time, which, when I say valuable time, I mean that's time that our doctor and paramedic aren't with the patient. It's time that that patient isn't being returned back to a primary care healthcare facility. So the more accurate we can get in, the location's a good one. Communication source, if there's a phone number that we can have so that we can actually contact somebody on the ground. And then from there, they'll also, RSQ would also task an ambulance as well, if that's possible, because things happen. Like, there could be any number of reasons why we have to turn around or we get diverted to another task. So they'll always try and throw multiple assets at it. So that could be ambulance, fire, police if free, and if needed, of course, depending on the job. But yeah, so then everyone will sort of, we'll all meet down in our operations room and we'll pull up the iPads. Everything's all about tech these days. So we've got all of this information on the iPad, and we'll find the location and then we'll make fuel plans. We need a certain amount of fuel, we need a certain amount of fuel to start, take off. Like, there's nothing's left to chance. Like, there's always enough fuel. There's always, where can we get fuel along the way? And if we need to stop for fuel somewhere, like, are they free? So there's a lot of planning that's going on in a really condensed amount of time. But it's also not the first time. There is a bit of a template to this. It's not as if, oh, how will we go and achieve this person? It's like, this is the protocol that we follow. And it's just a big flow chart. And we just go, yep, tick, yes, no, move on to this step. And it's just, it's all very systematic. And then weather is a huge factor. The fatigue of the crew, like our crews here can be out on road as well. So it's like, hey guys, are you okay to do this job? Like, are they fatigued? Have they been working all day? And then we're going to go and throw them into a helicopter and then off we go. You need to just consider all of these sorts of things as well. Can we land out there? And this is where the accuracy of the location is. Like, if we can land out there, or do we need to set up for a winch in advance? It's not the end of the world if we get out there and go, oh, actually we need to winch. All we'll do is just, we'll prep. But it's just those things, just reducing the amount of time between us getting to the person. And that's ultimately the goal, is the shortest amount of time to get to the patient. And then the next goal is the shortest amount of time to get that patient to a healthcare facility. But there's a huge amount of things that our doctor and paramedic can do in the field with the technology that has come so far. So like, we're basically flying a basic intensive care unit to the patient. And that's pretty cool. Like the medical technology has come so far to be able to do that. So that it really is that let's just get them to the patient and we'll sort out the next bit after that.
Yeah.
So then we get out there, and if we can land, it's either a paddock or it's a roadside, or if it's a roadside, if it's a car accident, for example, we can often, if there's cops on scene already or ambulance, we'll see the flashing lights. We'll try and find a place that's the widest bit that we'll try and land on the road. If not, we can call a truckie. And I have done it in the past. I've called them up on the radio and said, obviously we can see what truck we're looking at. I can't give you a rego number, but I was like, red B double heading south on Gregory Development Road. Can you stop? I need you to stop the traffic so we can land. And it has been done. It can be done. And like that's what I mean by the whole, it's not the skills, it's the decision-making and it's the problem-solving along the way. It's just like, what can I do with this situation to make this work for us? It's like, we need to stop the traffic. Big trucks will stop traffic. So we do that and then we'll land there. Yep, it's a pain for everyone behind, but they'll get the idea. And then we can get out, and landing is the best case scenario, because then you can just stop the spinning rotors, all the noisy bits, all the hot bits, and then everyone can get out and just throw everything we have at the patient and sort that out. From there on, obviously, if we've been able to get back in the aircraft and then we can take off and go to a hospital, that's great. But also, if we weren't able to land, of course, we set up and we perform a winch. Now, the winch is sort of our last, it's the highest risk thing that we can do. So that's the one we train for the most. But it's also, we don't leave that one to chance either. We definitely think about that one a lot, really risk assess it. It's like, is it worth it for this? Like, is the greater good going to be worth the risk of this? If the answer is yes, that's it. And we get in there and we perform that. And then we turn around and again, look for a primary healthcare facility. And all these things, like it's not just on the fly. Like, there's a lot of moving parts. There's a lot of people working in the background as well. RSQ are well aware of everything. We try to keep them updated so that they have, potentially they'll have a surgical team on the helipad, because we're bringing in a patient that has been in a car accident, for example, and they're just ready to perform the next step of that healthcare once we get them to the hospital. So we focus on doing our bit really well so that we can get that patient to the next part of the link in the chain, so that they can do their job really well.
Yeah.
And something talking about inter-hospital transfers before, just something Alan just said made me think of, was that sometimes it may be somebody coming from an accident being taken to that hospital and then needing advanced care. So that it may not just be anything that's actually, you know, they've been in hospital for a long time or anything. That may have been their first port of call, the local hospital.
Yeah.
They've looked at them and gone, no, these guys are going to need something a bit more serious. Let's get the helicopter. Let's get them over to Rocky or Gladstone or back to Brisbane, you know, if that's the case as well.
Yeah. It is amazing what you do, Alan. I mean, you watch some of these missions on TV. I know the other night I watched there was that really awful accident down the Avalon Air Show earlier this year with Glenn, one of the Paul Bennett pilots, and even watching – you know, what they could show unfold on TV, the reaction time and what they're doing and how they're getting this guy who's critically, critically injured, stabilized enough to get on a flight, to get to a trauma center. It's amazing what you guys do.
Look, there's many links in a big chain.
Yeah.
So like, it goes even further than that. Like, yep, we're the operators. However, there's the engineers that are very clever people that, like, basically a helicopter is a million spinning parts spinning around an oil slick waiting for metal fatigue to set in, and that's a helicopter.
Yep.
And they put it together and take it apart and put it back together and take it apart, and it's just constantly brand new because they keep it in such good nick. So without them, we can't fly. Without support, we can't fly and train. Without training, we can't be as proficient to be able to perform the tasks. Without the medic, like, it, you see how, like, you can just go on forever and ever, but like, there's so many links in a really big chain.
Moving from Newcastle up to, you know, Rockhampton, another regional, quite a community oriented town, how important is community when it comes to CAP rescue?
I would say community is pretty much everything, and by that, as broad of an answer as that is, I mean, everybody likes to feel a part of something. Everyone likes to have a purpose, and the community here, they like the purpose, knowing that we are in the community, and we're like, we're so embedded in it, like we're literally in the center of it. Everyone sees us flying over. The hospital is at the top of the hill. Everyone sees a helicopter landing on top of the hill. When the more people see us, the more they go, right, someone's got my back, basically. I reckon it also brings people out of their shell to go, I am going to go and explore. I am going to go and do things, because I know that, you know what, I'll do my best to be prepared, but if things happen, there is somebody that can actually help me out. I reckon just having that confidence, that support, just in the background, just knowing that we're there. And it's particularly in the small community, because like Kim mentioned before, in a small community, which this isn't tiny, but in a smaller community, someone has had something to do with Cap Rescue. Someone's been influenced or affected by it one way or another in their lifetime. And people love that, and it makes people feel good. And we're here for the warm and fuzzies, and we'd like to bring the warm and fuzzies.
Yeah, exactly. And speaking of the warm and fuzzies, I want to bring you in, Tracy. Obviously, Glencore is a big supporter of Cat Rescue. Tell us about that relationship.
Oh, yeah, look, Jess, I was looking into how long we've been supporters for Cap Rescue, and it predates my time with Glencore. It goes back into the Xstrata days. So many years now that I couldn't even find the starting date. You know, it's always been a part of what we do for community investment sort of in the region. You know, the Cap Rescue plays such an essential role, you know, in our community, as Alan's just been talking about. For us, it's more than, you know, just giving money. For us, it's a real partnership. It's a real support role, and we're so proud of that.
Obviously, being in the mining industry, Tracy, you know, you've got sites in quite remote parts, you know, of Queensland. How important is it for you to know that this service is available should the unthinkable happen, you know, out of the site?
Yeah, look, absolutely. Just our sites are quite rural and remote, and just knowing that Cap Rescue is there, and that can, you know, that they can come to our site in the event of something happening, is just so comforting. It's comforting for our people on site, but it's also comforting for, you know, just the community around, and all of those support services that go into those communities that make up our broader mining community. So our local, you know, local landholders, local neighbours, you know, closest towns. It's something that, you know, we just can't do without. So important.
Mm. Yeah, exactly. And we've been talking, Alan mentioned it and so did Kim, that, you know, everyone has some sort of a connection with Cap Rescue. And you were telling me a story before we jumped on about you went out to base, you went out to Rolleston on one of the emergency simulation training sessions with Cap Rescue. Tell us about that.
Yeah, look, I was so lucky. I was Johnny on the spot. Over the years, Cap Rescue have done, been a part of the emergency simulations that we have on site. So they're like emergency drills that our site, you know, emergency personnel and mine managers and broader personnel take part in. It's basically practicing so that, you know, if anything does happen, you know, they've got real time sort of practice for that. I was lucky enough to jump on the helicopter and head out for one a couple of years ago out at Rolleston. And look, the amount of ground that you cover in that time, it's a long way, but you do it so fast, you know, you're zipping across the landscape. Once we got there, you know, something else that really struck me as was incredible that we don't really think about was, and as Alan was saying, where can you land? You know, like sometimes there are designated landing spots, you know, especially on mine sites or, you know, on properties, but sometimes there isn't. And if it's, you know, if this is going to be out in a paddock or near bushland, it's, you know, there's so much, you know, technical sort of, you know, thought and planning that has to happen just on the spot, you know, in order for that helicopter to land. So being there and being a part of that process and seeing from that side how much expertise, training, planning, communication you know, that goes into that process was just incredible.
I feel like, Alan, no 2 days would be the same in your job. You'd never know what you're going to get.
No, and every day is a school day. Yeah. Every day is a school day.
And I know it's the case in New South Wales when we talk about the Westpac Rescue Helicopter Service, we often talk about the missions that they've done, rescue operations, you know, landing on a property to rescue someone, things like that. But there's a lot of inter-hospital transfers, isn't there, that happens, Alan and Kim, up in Queensland with CAP Rescue as well?
Yeah, you're correct. And it is our highest called for task that we do, and a lot of that's to do with these smaller rural areas not having the medical facilities that they need, or even just people to staff them. So sometimes it's just a matter of not having the diabetic treatments that you need, or being able to give birth because there's no birthing suite or anything like that, you know. Maternity ward, they need to get somewhere and they need to get there quickly to get help, and that's where we come in as well. And yeah, absolutely, it's a huge part of what we do, and it's why we have such a good relationship with Queensland Health. They do sponsor most of our operations, so about 70% we get through the funding from them, which is amazing. It is that other 30% that amazing organisations like Glencore do help with as well, and training and things like that is particularly one of the main things that Glencore helps support us with, so that on those days where you know, Alan's out there and he's not sure what to do, he thinks, oh, thank goodness I've had that training. And I think we've done probably over 100 hours in training this year alone. So, you know, when you take into account of how much it costs to run that helicopter, they can't do their job without that training, but we can't do that training without the support of places like Glencore.
Yeah, exactly. I was going to say that relationship with Glencore and other mining businesses is so, so important to keep you running, keep those helicopters in the air.
Absolutely, yeah. And it's not just, you know, obviously there's that direct correlation between workplace incidents, which of course sadly do happen. But as Tracy mentioned, it's the people who live around the area as well. But it's also, you know, mum and dad and the kids out having fun on mum and dad's days off as well. That's where we come into play, and that's where Alan was talking about that confidence, that knowing, you know, we're in the backyard and we can help them if we need to.
Yeah, exactly. It's such a vital service, and, you know, we can't thank you enough, Kim, for what you do, and Alan for what you do in saving so many lives.
It's got its own reward.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
That's actually
exactly. Well, everyone, thank you so much for joining us on this episode. It's been a pleasure having you all on. I think this is the most people we've had in one go on this little online little chat.
Yeah.
Pleasure.
Thanks for having us.
Yes.
My pleasure. Well, thank you for joining us for this episode of Digging Deeper with At The Coalface. You can download more episodes of the podcast on all your favourite podcast platforms, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, also on YouTube, Amazon Music, all the usual places. Make sure you leave us a rating and a review. We'd love to hear what you thought. And if you do have a story idea or something you'd like us to talk about on the podcast, please send me an email, jess@thecoalface.net.au. I'd love to hear from you. And we'll be back next time for another episode of Digging Deeper with At The Coalface.